let's get the hell out of the way if we're going to do it. If I got to send twice the amount of resources to that city, that's what we're going to do.
Some cities are positioning themselves as sanctuary cities in anticipation of potential mass deportations under President-elect Trump.
For Wednesday, November 20th, this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. At the U.S. Capitol, there's an effort to ban a transgender member of Congress from using women's restrooms.
House Speaker Mike Johnson is backing the move by fellow Republican Nancy Mace.
I fully support his statement. I fully support his policy. Does that stand the test of time? I want to make sure that it does.
Plus, the end of tennis legend Rafael Nadal's career.
And we speak to Princeton University's Eddie Glaude about the path forward after the election.
We're seeing wokeism as a kind of dog whistle, right? Because what was woke about Kamala Harris's campaign?
That's ahead. First, the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. The House Ethics Committee is not releasing the findings of its investigation into alleged drug use and sexual misconduct by Attorney General nominee Matt Gaetz. Committee Chair Michael Guest would not comment on details of today's much-anticipated meeting by the committee, telling reporters at this point there's been no agreement to release the report. The ranking Democrat on the committee, Susan Wilde of Pennsylvania, took exception with Guest's remarks, though.
He has implied that there was an agreement of the committee not to disclose the report. That is an untrue, to the extent that that suggests that the committee was in agreement or that we had a consensus on that, that is inaccurate.
Wilde says a vote on the matter was split along party lines. Some lawmakers on Capitol Hill have called for the public release of the committee's findings. If confirmed by the Senate, Gaetz would lead the Justice Department, which conducted its own investigation and declined to bring charges. President-elect Trump says he has picked former acting Attorney General Matt Whitaker to be the U.S. ambassador to NATO. Here's NPR Stephen Fowler.
Whitaker served in the Justice Department during Trump's first term and is another pick where loyalty to the president outweighs experience specific to the role. Trump said Whitaker would, quote, strengthen relationships with our NATO allies and stand firm in the face of threats to peace and stability. He will put America first. NATO is one of many national and global institutions that Trump has criticized over the years, especially with how much money other countries spend on the alliance. Earlier this year, he warned NATO allies that he would encourage Russia to, quote, do whatever the hell they want to member states who did not meet their requirements. Stephen Fowler, NPR News, Atlanta.
Jose Ibarra was sentenced to life without parole for the February murder of nursing student Lakin Riley on the University of Georgia campus. For member station WABE in Atlanta, Emily Wu Pearson has more.
Jose Ibarra was found guilty of all 10 charges against him, including felony murder, aggravated assault with the intent to rape, obstructing a 911 call, and tampering with evidence. Ibarra is a Venezuelan citizen who entered the U.S. illegally in 2022. He was granted temporary permission to stay in the country while his immigration case was being processed. Prosecutors described how, while on a morning run, Riley encountered Ibarra, who stopped her in her tracks, dragged her nearly 65 feet off the path, and beat her to death. Ibarra waived his right to a jury trial, and the judge returned the guilty verdict 15 minutes after closing arguments ended. The prosecution did not seek the death penalty in this case. For NPR News, I'm Emily Wu Pearson in Atlanta.
Stocks wound out the session on Wall Street with a mixed close. There were some notable declines, including shares of big box retailer Target, which dropped 20% on weaker than expected earnings. The Dow was up 139 points. The Nasdaq fell 21 points today. You're listening to NPR News in Washington. A major storm is now dumping rain on the Pacific Northwest, with high winds causing widespread power outages and knocking down trees, killing at least two people there. Falling trees are striking homes and falling across roadways in northwest Washington state, where about 450,000 people are still without power. The Weather Prediction Center has issued excessive rainfall warnings through at least Friday as a result of the storm, which is being dubbed a bomb cyclone due to its rapid intensification. The Federal Aviation Administration has released a plan that would dramatically increase the number of launches of the largest rocket ever built. As NPR's Jeff Bromfeld reports, the rocket is part of a plan to get to the moon and Mars.
The rocket is built by Elon Musk's company SpaceX. It's called Starship, and it's taller than the Statue of Liberty. Musk wants it to someday carry people to Mars, but to do that, Starship must be able to fly over and over again very quickly. To that end, the FAA wants to allow SpaceX to launch Starship as many as 20 25 times per year. The proposal would also allow the company to land Starship and its giant booster in Texas. Environmentalists are concerned about the proposal. They are already suing the FAA, claiming the agency has not adequately accounted for the impacts that Starship launches are having on nearby wetlands. Jeff Brumfield, NPR News.
While scientists know the universe is expanding at an accelerating rate, new findings are indicating there may also be something else going on. By examining the movement of galaxies over billions of years, scientists say it appears the energy may be weakening or changing over time. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age.
It's 6 minutes after 4 o'clock. Thank you for listening to KAXE and All Things Considered. I'm Jennifer Barr. We receive support from the Green Heron Bed and Breakfast, a four-season B&B on Pokegamon Lake, featuring home-cooked meals and all the amenities needed for a complete family vacation. More information at greenheronbnb.com. Loving the lake quietly. Flurries continue this evening and steady temps near 30 overnight. Highs tomorrow in the mid to upper 30s with cloudy skies.
Things Considered from NPR News, I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. Los Angeles has one of the highest undocumented populations in the country. The city has voted to approve a sanctuary city ordinance. It would protect the immigrants living in LA. And it comes in response to incoming President Donald Trump's promise to start mass deportations as soon as he takes office. Several other cities and states are taking a similar stance. And NPR's immigration correspondent Jasmine Garst has been keeping track of it all. Hi there.
Hi.
Jasmine, start if you can by just telling us, how would this ordinance protect immigrants living in the city?
So California has the largest number of undocumented immigrants in the country, and this policy would prohibit using city resources to carry out federal immigration enforcement. And there are already hundreds of sanctuary cities and counties in the U.S. Several have recently doubled down on this position.
So here's a question I've got. You mentioned the word federal, and immigration is a federal issue, right? So how much power does an ordinance like this actually have?
You're right. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, is federal. So the sanctuary designation often doesn't have legal teeth. Earlier today, Tom Homan, who President Trump has appointed as border czar, said on Fox News that while local officials are not obligated to help the federal government, they cannot interfere with ICE agents.
They don't want to help us get the hell out of the way if we're going to do it. If I got to send twice the amount of resources to that city, that's what we're going to do.
However, due to resource constraints, ICE does rely very heavily on the cooperation of states and counties. So, for example, for decades now, there's been a program of collaboration between local police departments and ICE. It's called 28-7G. The federal government cannot force a police department to participate, but over 130 jurisdictions choose to.
You've been doing a lot of reporting on the impact of mass deportation promises on mixed status families in America. How do people who live in sanctuary cities feel?
So many NPR listeners have written in sharing their stories. One woman, Daisy Ruiz, told me she grew up in New York, which is a sanctuary city, and she is a U.S. citizen, but her mom was not. And so she says when she was a child,
I would just stay awake in the middle of the night looking at the door, and I was so scared that ICE was gonna come and take my mom away. It did leave psychological issues for me. Like, I still have a lot of anxiety.
All this to say, sanctuary city or not, these promises of mass deportation, they have real effects on communities and on American citizens as well.
Jasmine, how has President-elect Trump reacted to sanctuary cities and states?
So early on in his administration, his earlier administration, Trump issued an executive order to withhold funding from sanctuary cities. That was deemed unconstitutional. He signaled that this time around, he's going to ask Congress to outlaw sanctuary cities. And I think it's going to come down to a battle between resources and local officials.
That's NPR's Jasmine Garst. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
The wealthiest countries are responsible for most of the pollution that causes climate change. So should they pay other countries for the damages, like intense storms? That's a key question at the COP29 negotiations going on in Azerbaijan this week. As Lauren Summer reports from NPR's Climate Desk, the first payments are starting to go out.
Cyclone Freddy was a monster storm, the longest-lasting tropical cyclone ever recorded. In 2023, it slammed into the east coast of Africa. It was 2 in the morning when floodwaters started pouring into Christopher Bengala's house. He lived in a small village in southern Malawi with his 6 kids.
My house was filled with water. The whole house was filled up with water, so the house eventually collapsed.
His livestock got washed away, but he managed to get his kids to higher ground. Food quickly became scarce.
We got to a point where we eat meat from animals that have died from the cyclone because we lacked food. And this was a very difficult moment in my life.
The government eventually moved him and thousands of others to a temporary camp. As a subsistence farmer, he didn't have the resources to start over. But then he got a cash payment of about $750. He used it to build a new house for his family in a village that's less prone to flooding.
They're better off here because they're not in danger of the water challenges that we had back in Makanga. This is a dry and upper land, so my children are okay and they're happy. They're living a happy life.
The cash payment Bengala got is from a new pot of money, specifically for disasters that are being made worse by climate change. It's known as loss and damage. The funds came from the government of Scotland and were given out by the nonprofit GiveDirectly. That's where Yolanda Wright works. She says countries like Malawi are suffering some of the worst damage from a problem they did little to cause.
The very poor, low-income households in Malawi have contributed the least to the climate problem. Many of them are not connected to electricity. They don't own a car or even a motorbike.
Almost half of all the greenhouse gas emissions since the Industrial Revolution have come from the United States and Europe. So a year ago, they agreed to create a loss and damage fund to compensate more vulnerable countries. Wright says the program in Malawi is one of the first pilots. About 2,700 people used it for things to restart their lives.
From basic agricultural materials, seeds, fertilizer, to livestock. They've also invested in getting their children back into school.
Richer countries have agreed to supply more of this loss and damage funding. Around $720 million was pledged so far, but much more will be needed. One study found the amount will be $250 billion per year by 2030. It's why many vulnerable countries are pushing for a bigger commitment at this year's climate negotiations, which are now underway. Philip Davis, Prime Minister of the Commonwealth of the Bahamas, is one of them.
We just hope that the global north and the nations whose economy is fueled by the emissions, they come to the plate and take up their responsibility to look at what they're causing us.
Like many island nations, Davis says the cost of hurricanes and rising sea levels will be insurmountable for the Bahamas, and richer nations will be affected by that too.
If they do nothing, they will be the worst for it. When my islands are swallowed up by the sea, then what do my people do? They either become climate refugees or they'll be doomed to watery grave.
The impacts of climate change, he says, don't stay within borders. Warren Summer, NPR News.
South Carolina Congresswoman Nancy Mace, a Republican, is leading an effort in Congress to ban transgender women from using facilities like bathrooms and locker rooms that do not correspond with the sex they were assigned at birth. This push comes after the election of Democrat Sarah McBride of Delaware. She will be the first transgender woman to serve in the House. NPR's Elena Moore is here to talk about how this is all unfolding. Hi, Elena.
Hey there.
So, Elena, can you just start by telling us what exactly Congresswoman Mace is proposing?
Yeah, she has two different proposals right now. The first is a measure to bar transgender women from entering women's bathrooms in the Capitol. And then today she followed up with legislation that would expand those limitations to all federal federal property across the country. And Mace is being direct about why she's doing this. I was in a group of reporters yesterday that asked if this effort is in response to McBride coming to Congress.
Yes, and absolutely, and then some. I'm absolutely 100% going to stand in the way of any man who wants to be in a women's restroom, in our locker rooms, in our changing rooms. I will be there fighting you every step of the way.
And there, Juana, she is referring to McBride as a man. Mace says the effort is about protecting women's rights. She's been public about being a survivor of sexual abuse and says that her experience is part of the reason she's working on this.
Okay. We know that Republicans control the House. They hold a narrow majority. How likely is it, though, that either of the things that Mace is proposing will actually pass?
House Speaker Mike Johnson, who is a staunch conservative, tried to toe the line on this a bit yesterday, calling for everyone to be treated with respect. Today, he made a stronger statement, saying that facilities in the Capitol and House office buildings are, quote, reserved for individuals of that biological sex. So I asked Mace about that move today, and here's what she said.
I fully support his statement. I fully support his policy. Does that stand the test of time? I want to make sure that it does.
You know, and she said she's still lobbying for the change in rules for the Capitol to be made official.
And what about Sarah McBride, the Delaware representative-elect? How has she responded to all of this?
Yeah, I mean, in general, McBride hasn't engaged a whole lot. She put out a statement on X a few days ago saying she sees this as a distraction by Republicans and she's focused on policy instead of, quote, manufacturing culture wars. But today, after Johnson's move to informally, you know, bar her from using those facilities at her soon-to-be workplace, McBride put out another statement saying she plans to follow Johnson's rules, even though she disagrees with them. And you know, she kind of extended an olive branch to her future colleagues, saying, quote, each of us were sent here because voters saw something in us that they value. And she went on to say she looks forward to seeing those qualities in every member come January.
Transgender issues have come up quite a bit in Republican politics recently. Help us understand, how does Mace's effort fit into that larger conversation?
Well, President-elect Donald Trump has spent millions of dollars on campaign ads saying Vice President Kamala Harris is, quote, for they, them. You know, and it was about her position on gender-affirming health care. But anti-trans messaging has become part of a broader Republican political strategy. Now it's also playing out within the halls of Congress.
That's NPR's Elena Moore. Thank you.
Thank you, Juana.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It's 4:18. Thank you for listening to All Things Considered on KAXE. I'm Jennifer Barr. In a moment, John Latimer's Daily Dose of Phenology. Support comes from Timberlake Lodge in Grand Rapids, offering an endless soup and salad bar for lunch and burgers and hand-cut steaks for dinner online at timberlakelodgehotel.com. Chance of flurries continues this evening, then steady temperatures overnight near 30 with blustery northwest winds. Cloudy tomorrow, highs in the mid to upper 30s and northwest winds 10 to 15.
On today's date, November 20th, 1999, I find what may be the last dandelion of the year. Dandelions are non-native. They were brought to the United States by European settlers, and they had good reason to bring them because dandelions are fast-growing and robust, and they grow in just about any climate. And they offer greens that can be eaten, the flowers can be turned into a wine, and the roots can be dug up, ground up, roasted, and turned into an ersatz coffee. So lots of uses for dandelions, which explains why they were brought to the United States. Now that they're here, you can see that they live up to their reputation as being survivors. These last dandelions typically are grown right close to the ground, wherever there's just a tiny bit of warmth, and they turn that warmth into growth. And you'll see a flower, and a day or two later, you'll see a stalk of a seed head sticking up a little bit higher, hoping that a puff of wind will spread its seeds on.
To be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates all from one platform. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from the Council for Interior Design Qualification, whose mission is to assess practitioner competency to create design solutions that safeguard public health, safety, and welfare. Learn more at CIDQ.org/NPR.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Israel's war against the Iran-backed militia Hezbollah has driven hundreds of thousands of civilians from their homes in southern Lebanon. Satellite data and eyewitness testimony gathered by NPR reveal vast destruction, meaning that for many residents, there's very little to return to. NPR's Ruth Sherlock has the story and a warning that it contains the sounds of war.
An Israeli soldier counts down.
Nine,
three,
eight,
two,
eight.
One. He presses a button. And the Lebanese hilltop village of Mahabib explodes.
Wow.
Rows of homes eviscerated in seconds. This video was released by the Israeli military, and it shows one of several such demolitions in Lebanese towns close to the border with Israel. Israel says it's destroying these homes because it says Hezbollah has tunnels that run under them. But the damage from these rigged blasts and from the intense aerial bombardment in this part of Lebanon is extreme. Videos from the rural border town of Khiam show homes and surrounding trees destroyed and on fire. Marwa Khres and her family fled Khiam when an airstrike hit the house beside theirs one night. We were afraid of the fighter jets, and when they hit near us, we heard the missiles. Then the power went out. It was truly terrifying. In Khiam alone, 741 buildings have been hit. That's according to Corey Scherer of New York's CUNY Graduate Center and Jamin van der Hoek of Oregon State University.
We get an idea of like the fraction of buildings that we detect as damaged.
They've built a map that draws on satellite data to show that 12,809 buildings across Lebanon have been damaged or destroyed.
The vast majority are focused in the southern regions along the border.
In these areas, Scherer says,
over half of buildings in a number of municipalities in the south are damaged or destroyed. So this is all qualitatively just to say that that corridor of destruction within 5 kilometers of the border is very much taking shape.
This corridor of destruction doesn't mean that Israel is trying to create a buffer zone that prevents civilians returning to their homes from villages where Hezbollah had support, says Israeli government spokesman David Mentzer.
Once we have completed the clearing of Hezbollah from our northern border, then Lebanese civilians will be able to come back into to their own homes.
Although Israel doesn't seem to be including the idea of a buffer zone in ceasefire talks with Lebanon, Wim Zwinnenberg from the Dutch organization PAX that focuses on protecting civilians in war says the Israeli military may be creating facts on the ground.
We have no land to go to. The houses are destroyed. So I think it clearly sends a message, we don't want you there.
And in a phone interview, Ghassan Hamoud, the mayor of Markaba, a devastated town on the border, questions what Israel considers Hezbollah targets. The school, the rescue services building, the health clinic, the sewing factory, it's all gone. And Israel has also been blowing up the water supply to these villages, says Wissam Dacher, the director of the South Lebanon Water Establishment.
The pumping lines, the wells, the pumps, the solar energy production plants, water storage tanks, everything was destroyed.
For Mona Fawaz, a professor of urban studies at the American University of Beirut, this is intentional, to make it harder for civilians to come back. She says in her village in the south, the Israeli military are destroying the places that make it feel like a community.
It's the village center,
It's the municipality. It's the old citadel of Tabnin that was hit. It's all these collective spaces that actually bring people together.
Earlier this month, Lebanese citizen Julia Ali posted on Instagram a video of herself playing a grand piano in her ancestral home in the town of Hiam. She plays in a high-ceilinged room underneath a glittering chandelier. Then she shared a video she found posted on the internet of an Israeli soldier playing her piano in what now remains of the home. The windows are blown out, the walls are shattered or burned. The soldiers laugh and sing along, and one dances over the rubble holding his gun. Watching the soldiers in her home, she writes, "It feels like they are trampling on my soul." Ruth Sherlock, NPR News.
In Florida's Big Bend region, the tiny island of Cedar Key produced nearly every clam eaten in Florida. Then came Hurricane Helene, destroying much of the island and its clam farms. It is a multi-million dollar industry, and as Catherine Welch reports, it's trying hard to make a comeback.
What makes clams from Cedar Key so unique is they're sweet, tender, and not so briny.
Clams in Cedar Key are well known for their taste. They're known nationwide, and you don't even have to have a brand name. It is Cedar Key clams.
Leslie Sturmer lives here and is a specialist with the University of Florida working with the local clam industry. In good years, it brings a harvest of up to 200 million clams that supplies nearly every store and restaurant across Florida.
The pipeline's quick. We get clams out, and within a day, maybe even less, they're at Costco's or your local grocery store.
In the past 14 months, Cedar Key farmers have weathered three hurricanes, Idalia, Debbie, and Helene.
All right, we're going to head out to the Dog Island clam leases. Oh, what a beautiful...
Michael Bobbitt is one of Cedar Key's nearly 200 farmers who grow clams in shallow waters on a muddy floor just off the island. They lease their plots from the state.
So we're situated between two rivers, the Wakasasa River this way and the Suwannee River that way, and it seems to deliver the perfect mix of salt and fresh water.
That's the ideal condition to raise clams in large black mesh bags. They'll grow from a seed to those ready to sell. White poles stick out of the water to mark where Bobbitt's clams grow. Just before Helene, Bobbitt planted 1,500 bags of clams, and only 30 survived the rough seas and storm surge. Most were swept away. Pulling up a bag that made it, he dumps dark black clams onto the back of his boat. It's not looking good.
Normally that's the sound of money, but right now that's the sound of dead clams.
They just couldn't handle the churning ocean waters. Bobbitt lost nearly all of his crop. He and the other farmers are now waiting for new clam seeds. They'll have to wait a few months because of Hurricane Milton. It came in right after Helene, but south of Cedar Key, damaging the main clam seed supplier in South Florida. Once the seeds arrive, University of Florida's Leslie Sturmer says it will take at least 15 months before farmers start making money again.
So it's going to take fortitude, patience, perseverance, resources, and any kind of financial disaster assistance that USDA and other programs can provide this industry in their recovery efforts.
And a lot of the recovery also depends on how long clam farmers are spared from another hurricane. For NPR News, I'm Catherine Welch in Cedar Key, Florida.
This is NPR News.
A couple's relationship is tested when one of them starts embracing QAnon conspiracy theories.
And I can remember slamming doors around here because I would just get so frustrated with, God, how can she believe this?
How they stayed together and found common ground tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News.
Thank you. Morning Edition starts at 5 o'clock tomorrow morning. Tune in for the Thursday morning show with myself. I'm Jennifer Barr and Kari Headland. We'll be talking with the early bird fishing guide, Jeff Sundin, at 6:20, and in the 8 o'clock hour, we'll learn about a new winter market in Cohasset. Coming up in a moment, National Native News. Programming is supported in part by the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs, serving Minnesota veterans and their families. MDVA wants to remind Minnesotans that November is National Veterans and Military Families Month. Be sure to thank a veteran for their service, commitment, and the sacrifices they've made to protect our country. And support comes from the Minnesota Historical Society, presenting holiday sleigh rides at the Forest History Center in Grand Rapids, featuring a horse-drawn sleigh ride through the Northwoods to make holiday memories in the great outdoors. Private group reservations available upon request. More information at mnhs.info/forestholiday.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Four major Native American groups are criticizing the presentation of Native voters in exit polls for this year's presidential campaign. As KLCC's Brian Bull reports, they say the data is misleading and potentially harmful.
In a joint release, the groups say exit poll data from Edison Research for the National Election Pool is concerning, given limits in scope and methodology. They say the sampling of 229 Native Americans does not reflect the diversity of Indian country, and add that exit polling was done at only 279 polling places on Election Day and 27 early in-person voting sites, and none were held on tribal lands.
The numbers weren't quite adding up for us.
Michael Johnson is president of Illuminate. He says earlier work done with the Native Organizers Alliance on what's called the Indigenous Futures Survey showed different results from the Edison NEP research.
While 48% of our community aligned with liberal ideologies, 52% of our community considered themselves moderate, conservative, or had no alignment to a party. And when we started seeing the exit poll data from Edison NEP, this didn't seem to square with some of the research we had done in our own community.
But many major news outlets went with Edison NEP's findings, which showed 34% of Natives in key battleground states identifying as left-leaning and 65% as right-leaning. Johnson says this is inaccurate and harmful.
The pervasiveness of misinformation creates a bias towards things that we don't know or communities that we're not a part of, and adds to the stereotypes, biases, and miseducation, and stands in the way of solidarity for all of our communities.
The other two groups contesting the Edison Research NEP data are the Native American Rights Fund and the National Congress of American Indians. In a statement, Edison Research tells National Native News that given factors like the small sample size and the potential sampling error, the survey data should not be taken as a definitive word on the American Indian vote. For National Native News, I'm Brian Bull.
After securing key state permits, hurdles remain for a Canadian energy firm's plan to reroute an oil and gas pipeline around the Bad River Tribe's reservation in Wisconsin. As Danielle Kading reports, that includes renewed calls from tribal leaders to shut down Enbridge's Line 5.
Bad River Tribal Vice Chair Patrick Bigboy says he's shocked and upset with the state's decision to grant permits for Enbridge's reroute. The company proposed a new 41-mile segment around the tribe's reservation after the band sued the company to shut down and remove Line 5 from its lands. Bigboy says he wants the pipeline completely out of the Bad River watershed.
It's now at the headwaters, which compromises more of the reservation and the waterways, wetlands, all of the things that are in line with the river and the flow of the water.
Bigboy says the federal government should uphold the tribe's treaty rights and water quality standards and deny federal approval of the project. Enbridge's Midwest Operations Director Paul Eberth says federal regulators will determine if its reroute poses impacts downstream.
We expect to be able to, like we did with the state, meet the conditions in order to be able to secure a permit.
An attorney for the tribe says they're evaluating next steps for a legal challenge. For National Native News, I'm Danielle Kading.
This week, tens of thousands of people demonstrated outside the New Zealand Parliament to oppose a bill Maori people say threatens their rights. Reuters reports the bill was introduced this month by members of Parliament who want to reinterpret a more than 180-year-old treaty signed between Indigenous people and the British. Videos across social media show people holding Maori flags and speakers talking about Indigenous rights, culture, and solidarity. The demonstration came days after an Indigenous lawmaker started a haka in Parliament to protest the bill. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
The Indian Arts and Crafts Board promotes Indian artists of federally recognized tribes through its online source directory. Information on this no-charge opportunity available at doi.gov/IA.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Workday. With AI at the core of its system, Workday is committed to delivering continuous innovation to prepare organizations for what's next. Workday, an enterprise platform for finance and HR rock stars. From the Kauffman Foundation, providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, and economic prosperity, regardless of race, gender, or geography. Kauffman.org. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. In the days since President-elect Donald Trump won back the White House, there have been conversations that try to better understand Trump's victory and the nation's apparent shift to the right. Eddie Glaude Jr. is a professor at Princeton University, and he's been in some of those conversations. He's also the former chair of the school's African American Studies program and the author of We Are the Leaders We've Been Looking For, which explores how voters can be more democratically engaged. He argues that while economic angst and dissatisfaction with the current administration are key reasons for why the election turned out the way it did, Trump's identity politics also lie at the heart of his appeal. We spoke earlier this week. How do you think about the results of the most recent election, where we saw a sweeping victories by President-elect Donald Trump and Republicans up and down the ballot? He won all seven swing states. There were moves by a number of demographic groups shifting towards the right. How do you parse that?
Well, you know, it's been hard to kind of make sense of it, but I think it's clear to me that race and gender played a role. I know that there are those who are making the claim that this is evidence that the Democratic Party has, you know, lost its way in relation to working class people. I don't think that's necessarily true, particularly because black and brown working class people did not vote for Trump in overwhelming numbers. So we need to unpack what we mean by the working class. We see split ticket voting. We saw Democrats in some places, Democratic senatorial candidates win, or they didn't lose by the same number or margins as Vice President Harris. So if Democrats were being punished for policies that harmed working class folk, or if they were being punished for inflation and the like, one would think you would see that across the board. But we saw instead split-ticket voting, not only in relation to senatorial candidates, but in terms of the abortion rights initiatives, 7 out of the 9 that passed. So we had American voters voting for a Donald Trump, right, voting for a Democratic candidate and voting for Donald Trump. We had American voters voting for abortion rights and voting for Donald Trump. Now, how do we understand that?
Yeah, what does that tell you?
It tells me that race and gender were at work because they decided, many people decided, without any evidence, that Donald Trump would respond to their lives. They would prefer someone like Donald Trump than they would Kamala Harris. Now, what's the substance of that preference? I think, to my mind, he gives folk a permission structure to blame others for their condition.
I am curious, what would you say to someone who makes the case that focusing, as some Democratic candidates did, on the rights of LGBTQ people in this country, focusing on racism in America, focusing on issues like abortion rights, it alienates voters for whom these issues don't have personal stakes. What would you say to them?
It's actually proving the point. You know, there is this shorthand about wokeness, you know, wokeism as the problem, that this insistence on identity politics, or that this has been alienating. But here we're seeing wokeism as a kind of dog whistle, right? Because what was woke about Kamala Harris's campaign? You know, it was, how could one put it? It was kind of textbook third way politics. The only thing that was woke or representational about her campaign was her body, the fact that she was a woman of color. So I think that that the concern, the so-called backlash to tending to the diversity of the nation actually proves the point.
You know, I covered politics for a long time, and in this election and in so many others, we've talked so much about the issues of immigration, the economy, mm-hmm. in the past few elections, abortion rights, as the issues that the American electorate cares most about. But I wonder for you, as we take a step back, what do those issues have to do with identity and what we know as identity politics? Does identity sit at the fault lines of the political divide in this country?
I think so. We know that political identity is kind of bound up with personal identity, right? It's more than just simply a set of political views or ideological positions. It's constitutive of who we take ourselves to be. So identity is at the heart of this thing.
Eddie Glaw Jr. of Princeton University, thank you so much.
Thank you. I appreciate you.
Last night, a tennis legend played his last professional game. As Spain was knocked out of the Davis Cup, Rafael Nadal's career came to an end. NPR's Miguel Macias reports from Seville, Spain.
Yesterday, right around 5 p.m. local time in Malaga, Spain, the Spanish anthem played one last time for Rafael Nadal as a professional player.
Y a continuación suena el himno nacional de España.
An emotional Nadal stood next to his teammates, to many the greatest Spanish athletes of all time, a 22 Grand Slam winner. His legendary games with Roger Federer or Novak Djokovic will live in the collective memory of tennis fans around the world. Before last night's games had even started, Nadal held back tears as he heard the crowd cheering him. Everyone wanted Spain to go on to the next round and extend Nadal's career for a few more days. But as it turned out, last night was Nadal's last dance.
I remember the first time I saw him playing.
Cristina Gago is a former professional tennis player. She recalls seeing Nadal play back in 2004 in Seville during his very first Davis Cup.
Even though he was very young, you could feel how he believed in himself, how he was going for every ball, no matter what difficult was, and reach that ball that looked like impossible.
And that became Nadal's hallmark, to never give up, overcoming impossible deficits in any game he played year after year. Gago says Nadal influenced her deeply.
Saying to myself, come on, Cristina, you are Rafa Nadal. It's a way to cheer me up, to believe that even though that things are very difficult, I can make it.
Pedro Fullana is a sports journalist with Cadena SER. He grew up in the same village as Nadal, in the island of Mallorca. He was there last night. Fullana says that Nadal would play soccer on the streets using pine trees as goalposts. He says that really Nadal could have succeeded in any sport. But if there's one thing that everyone seems to agree on, it is Nadal's personal qualities. Sebastian Fest is a journalist and author of the book, Thank You, The Legacy of Rafael Nadal.
I've seen lots of athletes in my journalistic career, and I don't think I have seen anyone saying gracias, saying thank you, so often. He says thank you to the ball person, to the chair umpires, to the sponsor, to his rivals, to the journalists, to whatever he comes across.
Fest says this is not the usual behavior you find in huge sports stars. Back in Malaga, just past midnight, and after more than 7 hours of tennis matches, Rafael Nadal stepped on the court, lights dimmed down, and took the microphone.
Buenas noches a todos.
And despite the magnitude of his legacy as a tennis player,
the way that I would like to be remembered more is like a good person from a small village in Mallorca that...
Miguel Macias, NPR News, Seville, Spain.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. You probably know football is mainly about throwing, catching, and running the ball. So NFL kickers have never been, shall we say, main characters. But this season, kickers have become essential, and that is starting to change the way the sport is played. NPR's Becky Sullivan has the story.
Once upon a time in the NFL, hitting a long field goal to win a game wasn't a sure thing.
It's going to be a 47-yard field goal attempt.
Back in Super Bowl 25, the Buffalo Bills were trailing the New York Giants by just 1 point. With 8 seconds left, the Bills lined up for a field goal. All they needed was their kicker, Scott Norwood, to hit it. But he missed, prompting the famous call from ABC's Al Michaels.
No good. Wide right.
Back then, in the 1990 season, the odds of making a field goal from that distance were worse than a coin toss. That year, kickers made only one of every three of the longest field goals they tried. Compare that to this season. Kickers are now hitting almost 3 of 4 field goals that are 50 yards or longer.
It's pretty impressive.
This is Michael Husted. He was a kicker in the 90s, mostly with the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. One big difference between then and now, he tells me, is coaching. Back when he was getting started, almost no one had a kicking coach. Now kickers at all levels, from high school to the pros, work with coaches like Husted, who teach them the techniques he had to learn on his own. Still upper body, power from your core.
It's very synonymous with a golf swing. It's not about trying to hit the ball as hard as you can. It's about being fluid and loose and relaxed.
Coaches also help with weightlifting regimens and the mental aspect too. How to manage the intense pressure of those end-of-game scenarios. The other key difference that has really uncorked this long field goal trend isn't the kickers at all, says Dan Orner.
10 years ago, guys were hitting 60-yarders in practice. I think the coaches weren't confident enough.
Orner coaches dozens of high-level college kickers. He says head coaches have completely transformed the way they think about those guys.
They value the kicker. They value the punter. The younger head coaches, you see a lot of those guys going, we got this weapon of mass destruction. We might as well use it.
The result, teams are trying longer field goals nearly twice as often as they did just a few years ago.
Obviously something that you take note of, it changes the game, it changes strategy.
This is Jeff Miller, an NFL spokesman. Last month, he was asked whether league officials would consider changing the rules to make it harder for kickers. He said they're going to take a look at it. One idea would be to narrow the goalposts. Right now, the uprights are about 18 feet apart. Narrowing them to 16 or even 14 feet would make things harder, for a little while at least, says the former kicker Michael Husted.
Eventually, I think they'll probably just have a pull back there with a cowbell, and you have to hit that at the rate these guys are going.
Until then, the NFL's longest ever field goal might be the league record with the shortest life expectancy. That record belongs to Justin Tucker of the Baltimore Ravens, who hit a 66-yarder back in 2021. This season, someone came closer than ever. Brandon Aubrey of the Dallas Cowboys got one from 65 yards in September. I talked to Tucker after a game this month. He told me, from that distance, it's not just about the kicker.
Anytime a guy's trying to make a kick from the opposite side of the logo, everything's got to be just right. The snap's got to be there. The hold's got to be there. The conditions have got to be right.
In other words, it's a perfect storm that may or may not happen anytime soon. This season isn't over yet. The kicks are harder to make in the winter. Balls don't travel as far in the cold. Wind is a challenge, too. So Tucker's record may yet live to see one more year. Becky Sullivan, NPR News, Baltimore.
You're listening to All Things Considered.
It is 4:48. Thank you for listening to KAXE and All Things Considered. I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up next, we'll hear about a new book called The Serviceberry. Botanist Robin Wall Kimmerer argues that humans would be wise to learn from the circular economies and reciprocity and abundance that play out in natural ecosystems. Coming up at 5:30, the Up North Report, local news from our region. At 6 o'clock, as it happens, news from a Canadian perspective with the CBC, and at 7, Doug Danger, our volunteer host for On the River, bringing you a great mix of music. Support comes from Paul Bunyan Communications, powered by the GigaZone, offering fiber optic fast internet speeds up to 10 gig and GigaZone Blast Wi-Fi, featuring Wi-Fi 6 technology to support devices wirelessly. Chance of flurries continues this evening, and then steady temperatures near 30 degrees overnight, blustery northwest winds. Cloudy tomorrow, highs in the mid to upper 30s, and northwest winds 10 to 15. For Friday, partly sunny, highs in the low 30s. programming is supported in part by Pickett Agency, an official Mincher partner. It's open enrollment season, and Pickett Agency is here to support the Bemidji community with health plan enrollment and guidance. More information by calling 218-751-1213 or by visiting pickettagency.com. You can learn to curl at Itasca Curling Club in Grand Rapids this Friday starting at 6 p.m. Bring clean shoes and wear comfortable clothes. And the Beltrami County Historical Society welcomes the First City Singers tomorrow at noon. The group will perform and share stories about the organization. Let us know about events happening in your community. Send us an email, psa@kaxc.org. You can watch the Twilight Holiday Parade on Chestnut Street in Virginia this Saturday at 5:15. Fireworks will follow on the shores of Silver Lake.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. Since she's a botanist, let's say Robin Wall Kimmerer's last book bloomed slowly. It was called Braiding Sweetgrass, Indigenous Wisdom, Scientific Knowledge, and the Teachings of Plants. A small nonprofit press published the book in 2013. It spread by word of mouth. And 7 years later, it hit the New York Times bestseller list in paperback. It has now sold more than 2 million copies, and the author was recognized with a MacArthur Genius Grant. Professor Kimmerer, who is a member of the Citizen Potawatomi Nation, has followed up Braiding Sweetgrass with a new book-length essay that explores similar themes. It's called The Serviceberry: Abundance and Reciprocity in the Natural World. So good to have you with us.
It's an honor to talk with you.
The Serviceberry begins with a scene of harvest. So tell us what you were doing and what went through your mind.
I was harvesting serviceberries, also known as Juneberries, and they were so abundant. I was picking them by the handful and really got to thinking about kind of the economy of abundance and what the generosity of a tree like serviceberries could teach us about our own human economies.
Let's dig into that phrase, economy of abundance, because at the heart of this book, you, a botanist, are making an economic argument. What is the shift that you're encouraging people to make, both conceptually and in their actual lives?
Yeah, you know, what I'm really interested in is thinking about how could we imagine a human economy with a kind of currency that works like ecological economies, the economies of nature. And when we think about the extractive capitalist economy that we're all enmeshed in, it breaks a lot of the rules of how natural landscapes are organized. And so it's really an inquiry to say, could we imagine a human economy which is based on reciprocity rather than extraction? Could we imagine an economy which is circular and regenerative rather than an industrial pipeline, etc.? So it's kind of an examination of biomimicry of what could we learn from the economies of nature.
And it does exist in some places in our lives. As you say, this doesn't have to come entirely from our imagination. What are some places in the human world where we can see this in practice today?
Well, you know, gift economies are quite well known and widespread in indigenous cultures, particularly traditional peoples. So there are many examples, both in my Potawatomi cultures and Potlatch cultures, in Polynesian cultures, that use the gift economy in order to distribute goods and services without a market. But, you know, I think there are also lots of examples in our everyday life, if we really pay attention. You know, one that I like to think about is things like little free libraries. Mm-hmm. That's a way of sharing literature with your whole community, right? And then we scale that to public libraries. So the notion is we don't all have to own everything. Abundance comes from sharing what we have.
As I read it, I wondered if public radio could be considered a gift economy, but that probably shows my own bias.
You know, you're absolutely right. We just finished Pledge Week here, and I was thinking that the whole time. I thought, oh, I should have included NPR as a gift economy. It totally is.
You write, recognizing enoughness is a radical act in an economy that is always urging us to consume more. What does that mean in practice, to recognize enoughness?
Well, you know, I think of it as a radical act because of all of the messages that we get from corporate America telling us, oh, if you buy this, you'll be more successful, you'll be happier, you just can't live without this, right? There are all these messages that tell us consume, consume, consume. In fact, you know, we are often referred to not as citizens, but as consumers. And so this idea of putting the brakes on consumption is really important, particularly when we know that climate change is a product of hyperconsumption, right? The more we consume, the more damage that we're doing to the planet. And so if we can start to put the brakes on consumption through practices like gratitude and reciprocity, we say, you know, I already have everything that I need. I really don't need to buy that next thing. Instead, I'm going to invest in relationship. I'm going to invest in belonging rather than belongings. And, you know, I think it's good for, I know it's good for the planet, but it's also good for us.
As somebody who is a trained botanist, how did trained economists respond when you approached them and started to describe some of these ideas?
I was really pleased that they listened with me and could imagine, in fact, in many cases, are already engaging in this idea of biomimicry, of how can we change our economic systems so that they don't degrade the very life support systems that all life depends on. So ecological economists are already thinking in this direction and working in really creative ways that, as a botanist, I can only barely understand. And so it was exciting to me to know that the economics community is thinking about this, at least some of them.
Has it been surprising for you to see the way these ideas that you put forward in such a humble, small way initially in 2013 have just, I mean, forgive the metaphor, but spread like a tenacious plant?
Yes, it is to me, again, really uplifting and gives me a lot of hope, because you know what I hear from readers practically every day is this real longing to live in a world that values the native species around us, that values the natural world. And it was as if Braiding Sweetgrass and the work of so many others gave people a permission to passionately love the world and to act on its behalf. One of the things that is most moving to me is that people will write to me and say, you issued an invitation to reciprocity, to give back to the earth. And so here's what I'm doing. There are people who are, you know, changing their classrooms, who are changing their careers, who are changing their landscapes. And to me, it represents a movement in which people are reclaiming their role as healers of land, not just despoilers of land.
Robin Wall Kimmerer's latest book is The Service Berry, Abundance and Reciprocity in the Natural World. So good to talk to you. Thank you.
Thank you, Ari.
This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from C3 AI. C3 Generative AI works to enable rapid access to traceable, hallucination-free insights from enterprises using any LLM, helping turn the invisible into the obvious. This is Enterprise AI. From Procter & Gamble, maker of Nervive. Nervive Nerve Relief is designed to reduce occasional nerve aches, weakness, and discomfort in hands or feet due to aging. Learn more at nervivehealth.com. From Imaginable Futures, celebrating the hard work, commitment, and achievements of the 1 in 5 college students who are parents. More at imaginablefutures.com. And from the Public Welfare Foundation, committed to advancing transformative youth and criminal justice reforms.
It's a minute before 5 o'clock. Thank you for listening to 91.7 KAXC Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXC Bagley, Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker. We're telling the stories of Northern Minnesota through music, news, conversation, and events. Find more at KAXC.org. I'm Jennifer Barr. Stay tuned for another hour of All Things Considered, including the Up North Report, local news from our region at 5:30. Support comes from Headwaters Unitarian Universalist Fellowship in Bemidji, gathering at 10 a.m. on Sundays now through May at the Headwaters Peace Center. HUF is an inclusive space to seek truth, practice love, and celebrate life. Learn more at headwatersfellowship.weebly.com. Our chance of flurries continues this evening. Steady temperatures overnight.